books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Talking Books, this is Read On, the audiobook show. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, we'll look at Percival Everett's multi-award-winning book, James. Plus, with Catherine Harkup, we'll discover some super spy science and the poisons of Agatha Christie. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library. All coming up on today's Read On. Percival Everett said the idea for James came to him while he was playing tennis. He stopped and thought, I wonder if anyone has written Huck Finn from Jim's point of view. The subsequent novel, James, a retelling of the adventures of Huckleberry Finn from the perspective of Huck's enslaved companion, won the National Book Award for Fiction and was also on the Booker shortlist. The audio version, available commercially and also from RNIB Talking Books, is read by Dominic Hoffman.
That evening I sat down with Lizzie and six other children in our cabin and gave a language lesson. These were indispensable. Safe movement through the world depended on mastery of language, fluency. The young ones sat on the packed dirt floor, and I was on one of our two homemade stools. The hole in the roof pulled the smoke from the fire that burned in the middle of the shack. Papa, why do we have to learn this? White folks expect us to sound a certain way, and it can only help if we don't disappoint them, I said. The only ones to suffer when they are made to feel inferior is us. Perhaps I should say, when they don't feel superior. So let's pause to review some of the basics. Don't make eye contact, a boy said. Right, Virgil. Never speak first, a girl said. That's correct, February, I said. Lizzie looked at the other children and then back to me. Never address any subject directly when talking to another slave, she said. What do we call that? I asked. Together, they said, signifying. Excellent. They were happy with themselves, and I let that feeling linger.
Now, we last spoke in 2022 when The Trees was on the shortlist, and you said you were the last person you should ask for a synopsis of your book. But can we try and can we jump off with your description of the novel James?
Well, this one is slightly easier to synopsize it. It's ostensibly a retelling of the story of Adventures of Huckleberry Finn as told from the point of view of the enslaved man, Jim.
Let's try some situational translation, something extreme first. You're walking down the street, and you see that Mrs. Holliday's kitchen is on fire. She's standing in her yard, her back to her house, unaware. How do you tell her? Fire, fire, January said. Direct, and that's almost correct, I said. The youngest of them, lean and tall 5-year-old Rachel, said, Lordy, miss him. Looky there. Perfect, I said. Why is that correct? Lizzie raised her hand. Because we must let the whites be the ones who name the trouble. And why is that? I asked. February said, because they need to know everything before us, because they need to name everything. Good. Good. You all are really sharp today. Okay. Let's imagine now that it's a grease fire. She's left bacon unattended on the stove. Mrs. Holliday is about to throw water on it. What do you say? Rachel? Rachel paused. Missums, that water gonna make it worse. Of course, that's true. But what's the problem with that? Virgil said, you're telling her she's doing the wrong thing. I nodded. So, what should you say? Lizzie looked at the ceiling and spoke while thinking it through. Would you like for me to get some sand? Correct approach, but you didn't translate it. She nodded. Oh, Lord, Missums, ma'am. You want for me to get some sand? Good.
You don't shy away from the language of Twain, language we might balk at today. Is that a deliberate choice?
Well, it's a deliberate choice insofar that as I'm a writer who attempts to tell the truth, of course, you're referring to that particularly unfortunate six-letter word that everyone's afraid to say in our culture, even in historical context. But the word was used in the 19th century, and it tells us about the people who are using it. So in that way, the word not only fits, but is necessary. Replacements won't serve.
What did you think of the sanitized versions of Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn that came out a few years back that removed that word?
Well, I mean, I understand the impulse, the sensitivity that would prompt someone to do it, but it's woefully inadequate to replace that word with the word slave. It changes the story. It softens the story. The terror of the story, the sadness of the story is lost. That word does have a lot of power, and it does a lot of work in the text.
I've heard it described as a well-intentioned act of cultural vandalism.
Yeah, that's very good.
Yes. Now, how many times did you read Huck Finn before writing James?
Well, the exercise for freeing myself from Twain's text was to read it 15 times in a row. I learned after 15 times that 11 probably would have been enough.
Did you love it or hate it by the end?
I fairly hated it by then. I accomplished my goal, which was to immerse myself in that world and to commit it to memory. And I'd also completely divorced myself from all of the words.
Gets some. It's hard to say. This from Glory, the oldest child, the S's. That's true, I said. And it's okay to trip over it. In fact, it's good. You want for me to get some sand, Miss Holiday? What if they don't understand? Lizzie asked. That's okay. Let them work to understand you. Mumble sometimes, so they can have the satisfaction of telling you not to mumble. They enjoy the correction and thinking you're stupid. Remember, the more they choose to not want to listen, the more we can say to one another around them.
Now, is it true that Twain abandoned this novel halfway through and only came back to it for a bit of a payday?
I think it was 7 or 8 years that he left work on the novel, and it was probably three quarters done, which explains that there's sort of a marked difference where he comes back. The tone has changed. The novel's not quite the same. There are any number of reasons that this could be true, partly because of the distance from it, but also perhaps more mercenary reasons. The reinsertion of Tom Sawyer might be to gain a larger readership.
Do you think Jim's intelligence was already present in Twain's work, although a bit hidden?
No, I think that his humanity and his kindness are certainly on display. But the fact that he is so superstitious and subject to the whims and practical jokes of this 14-year-old boy, you know, it plays into the 19th and persisting 20th century depiction of the slave as superstitious and simple-minded.
That's a sort of display Jim puts on when he's being Jim, because there's a scene early in the book where James is teaching his children how to code switch, how to talk like the white people expect.
Yes.
The cultural differences are enormous, but it reminds me in an opposite way of the Scots language. You know, we were always told we couldn't speak that way, you shouldn't speak that way, you know, it's guttural, it's common, you shouldn't speak like that. But Jim is actually encouraging his children to do it so they would be safe.
Yes. And I think that's what oppressed, enslaved, imprisoned people do quite naturally, always have, and they always will. They find ways to speak to each other. They don't allow entry of their oppressors, but also they find ways of safe passage through through a hostile world.
Why did God set it up like this? Rachel asked. with them as masters and us as slaves. There is no God, child. There's religion, but there's no God of theirs. Their religion tells that we will get our reward in the end. However, it apparently doesn't say anything about their punishment. But when we're around them, we believe in God. Oh, lordy lord, we's be believing. Religion is just a controlling tool they employ and adhere to when convenient. There must be something, Virgil said. I'm sorry, Virgil. You might be right. There might be some higher power, children, but it's not their white God. However, the more you talk about God and Jesus and heaven and hell, the better they feel. The children said together, and the better they feel, the safer we are. February, translate that. The more better they feels, the more safer we be. Nice.
Now, James is a literate man, but at that time, am I right in saying it was illegal for a slave to be literate?
I don't know if it was illegal. I can't say that. It certainly wasn't welcomed, and it certainly would have been a danger because they would be perceived as dangerous. You know, there's a reason that fascist regimes rush to burn books when they come to power, and that's because books are scary to them. Education is scary to them.
Now, there's humor in the book and sort of contrasts with its serious undertones. How do you use humor as a tool in literature?
Well, this, of course, is a lesson I learned from Mark Twain. I am an admirer of his humor. When you make someone laugh, when you can get them laughing, you've done something to them. You've relaxed them. They're in a slightly more vulnerable state. It's almost an expression of trust. And once they open up in that way, you can do other things to them, some more serious things.
Now, there are a number of different dialects in the book, a number of different voices. Were you responsible for the casting of Dominic Hoffman as the audiobook narrator?
Responsible? I heard him and approved it. I don't know if I'm responsible. I'm happy to take credit for that because he does such a wonderful job. So let's say that, yes, I'm responsible for it.
But now it's available in audio and in Braille. Is it important that it's now accessible to people who, for whatever reason, can't read print?
Oh, yes, by all means. I have a really expansive idea of reading, and it doesn't mean seeing words on a page. It's receiving story in whatever way one can.
Now, one thing we won't get if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of the book?
Well, the American cover is simply the word James with a very large J that extends from the top of the page to the bottom. And that's an homage to Joyce's Ulysses. When I was a kid, a teenager, that was it had a very large U, and I always remembered that. It struck me. And on the British cover, there is, of course, the title James, but then there's a depiction of a man, ostensibly an enslaved man, obviously on a trek.
Now, you've had great success in Hollywood with American fiction coming from Erasure. I don't know if there's another way to say this, but have you sold James?
Yes, and it is unfortunate language that I have sold James. Yes, Steven Spielberg will be producing the film.
Huck caught me as I was hauling sacks of chicken feed from the buckboard to the shed in the back of the Widow Douglas's house. He was studying on something intently, and I could tell he wanted to talk. "What be on your mind, Huck?" "Prayers," he said. "Do you pray?" "Yes, sir. I prays all the time." "What do you pray for?" he asked. "I prays for all sort of things. I pray once that the little girl February would get better when she be sick." "Did it work?" "Well, she be better now." I sat on the buckboard and looked at the sky. "I pray for rain once. Did it work that time?" "It did rain, sure enough. Not right away, but eventually." "Then how you know God done it?" Reckon I don't. But don't God do everything? Who else make it rain? Huck picked up a rock, studied it in his hand for a bit, then hurled it at a squirrel high on an elm branch. Wanna know what I thinks? Huck looked at me. I thinks praying is for the people round you what wants you to pray. Pray so Miss Watson and Widow Douglas hears you and asks Jesus for what you knows they wants. Make your life a sight easier. Maybe. Every now and then toss in something like a new fishing pole or like that so they can scold you. Huck nodded. That makes sense. Jim, you believe in God? Why, sure enough I does. If there ain't no God, then how we get this here wonderful life? Now, you run on and play.
Percival Everett, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more from Percival Everett at the end of today's show in the Books of Your Life. But for now, let's take our first visit to the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. The Great Sea, A Human History of the Mediterranean by David Aboulafia was donated by Penguin Random House.
Carved out millions of years before mankind reached its coasts, the Mediterranean Sea became a sea between the lands, linking opposite shores once human beings traversed its surface in search of habitation, food, or other vital resources. Early types of humans inhabited the lands bordering the Mediterranean 435,000 years before the present, to judge from evidence for a hunter's camp set up near modern Rome. Others built a simple hut out of branches at Terra Amata near Nice and created a hearth in the middle of their dwelling. Their diet included rhinoceros and elephant meat, as well as deer, rabbits, and wild pigs. When early man first ventured out across the sea's waters is uncertain. In 2010, the American School of Classical Studies at Athens announced the discovery in Crete of quartz hand axes, dated to before 130,000 BC, indicating that early types of humans found some means to cross the sea, though these people may have been swept there unintentionally on storm debris. Discoveries in caves on Gibraltar prove that 24,000 years ago, another species of human looked across the sea towards the mountain of Jebel Musa, clearly visible on the facing shore of Africa. The first Neanderthal bones ever discovered in 1848 were those of a woman who lived in a cave on the side of the Rock of Gibraltar. Since the original finds were not immediately identified as the remains of a different human species, it was only when 8 years later similar bones were unearthed in the Neander Valley in Germany that this species gained a name. Neanderthal man should carry the name Gibraltar woman.
For over 3,000 years, the Mediterranean Sea has been one of the great centres of civilization. David Aboulafia's The Great Sea is the first complete history of the Mediterranean, from the erection of temples on Malta around 3,500 BC to modern tourism. Ranging across time and the whole extraordinary space of the Mediterranean, from Gibraltar to Jaffa, Genoa to Tunis, and bringing to life pilgrims, pirates, sultans, and naval commanders, this is the story of the sea that has shaped much of world history.
The Gibraltar Neanderthals made use of the sea that lapped the shores of their territory, for their diet included shellfish and crustaceans, even turtles and seals, though at this time a flat plain separated their rock caves from the sea. But there is no evidence for a Neanderthal population in Morocco, which was colonised by Homo sapiens sapiens, our own branch of humanity. The straits apparently kept the two populations apart. In the long period of the Lower and Middle Paleolithic, Old and Middle Old Stone Age, navigation across the Mediterranean was probably rare, though some present-day islands were accessible across land bridges later covered by the rising sea. The Coscaire Grotto near Marseille contains carvings by Homo sapiens from as early as 27,000 BC, and paintings earlier than 19,000 BC. It now lies well below sea level, but when it was inhabited, the Mediterranean shore lay a few miles further out. The first good evidence for short sea crossings comes during the Upper Paleolithic, the late Old Stone Age, that is, before about 11,000 BC. At this point, visitors set foot on Melos in the Greek Cyclades in search of the volcanic glass obsidian used in stone tools and offering sharper edges than flint.
The Great Sea, a human history of the Mediterranean by David Abulafia, is read by Jonathan Keeble and runs for 26 hours and 21 minutes.
Newly arrived in the library, we have The Phoenix Ballroom by Ruth Hogan.
Venetia Hamilton Hargreaves wondered whether sandwiches and sausage rolls might have been a better choice than canapés as she waited for her husband's corpse outside St. Paul's Church. It would soon be lunchtime and surely people would prefer something more substantial than a sliver of smoked salmon on a cracker smeared with cream cheese. Well, it was hard cheese now, too late to change. The air was heavy and humid, and a heat haze shimmered off the gleaming black paintwork of the hearse. A storm was forecast. The coffin was crowned with an elaborate spray of lilies and ivy, and the blooms trembled with every step the pallbearers took as Venetia followed them down the aisle, the same aisle that she had walked as a bride, carrying freesias and lily of the valley, on the arm of her handsome groom, almost 50 years before. A sad but somehow satisfying symmetry. This time she had her son at her side.
Recently widowed Venetia Hamilton Hargreaves is left with a huge house, a bank balance to match, and an uneasy feeling she's been sleepwalking through the last 50 years. Determined to live fully again, she embraces life with an enthusiasm and purpose she'd forgotten she could muster. Buying the dilapidated Phoenix Ballroom, and with it a drop-in centre and spiritualist church, could be seen as reckless, but Venetia's generosity, courage and kindness provide a refuge for a touching cast of damaged and lonely people who find their chosen family. As their stories intertwine, long-buried secrets are revealed, missed opportunities seized, and lives are renewed as the Phoenix lives up to its name. A story of hope and second chances across the generations.
It had been her son, Heron, who had insisted on canapés, specified the champagne and booked the hotel where both were to be served after the service. Venetia's suggestions had been swatted aside because Heron had assured her that he knew best. He had even chosen her outfit and she had let him have his way. For now. He took his place beside her in the front pew as the coffin was set down on trestles before the altar. His face was red with the effort of containing his emotions, and he clutched a meticulously folded handkerchief in his fist in case eventually he should fail. Heron was an unfortunately comic misnomer for one so deficient in stature and grace, but his grandfather had been a keen amateur ornithologist. He had named his children Hawk, Osprey, Nightingale, and Swan, and his sons had continued the practice with their own offspring. With his scarlet cheeks and tubby torso, poor Heron looked more like a crotchety Christmas card robin. Venetia placed her hand on his arm and gave it a gentle squeeze. She felt him tense at her touch and returned her hand to her lap. In contrast to her son's discomfort, Venetia was surprisingly sanguine for her public debut as a widow. She would miss her husband, of course she would, but in the way that one misses a comfortable cardigan that shrunk in the wash and become too tight to wear. The church was almost full. Hawk, Hamilton Hargreaves, had been a popular and well-respected man, and he would have been gratified to see such an impressive turnout for his last hurrah. He had chosen the order of service himself, and Venetia was grateful. It had saved her the worry, and she was glad for him that he was getting exactly what he wanted. After welcoming the congregation with respectful solemnity, the vicar announced the first hymn, and as they stood to sing Jerusalem, the small boy beside Venetia clattered to his feet, dramatically brandishing his hymn book in both hands.
The Phoenix Ballroom by Ruth Hogan is read by Joan Walker and runs for 8 hours and 55 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And we'll have another two books later on in today's show. But now, let's find out about the science behind James Bond and the chemistry behind Agatha Christie with Catherine Harkup. Dr. Catherine Harkup is a former chemist and author. She completed a doctorate on her favourite chemicals, phosphates, and then went on to further postdoctoral research before realising that talking, writing and demonstrating science appealed a bit more than hours slaving over a hot fume hood. Among her many science books are A is for Arsenic, The Poisons of Agatha Christie, more of which later on. We'll also touch on her book Making the Monster, The Science of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. But Catherine was at the Wigtown Book Festival to talk about super spy science. Science, death and tech in the world of James Bond.
A white dot moves across the screen. A man appears at its centre. The circle follows him as he walks. Suddenly he turns, aims a gun, and shoots. Red washes down the screen, and loud familiar notes blast out from the speakers. Bright colours, abstract shapes, and silhouettes of writhing women appear. Within seconds, we know exactly where we are and what to expect, more or less.
The audio version of Super Spy Science is read by Nikki Diss.
The James Bond theme, the gun barrel sequence, the highly stylized titles, it was all there from the start. The only things missing from the first Bond film were a pre-title sequence and a title song. The following 24 films would be introduced in almost the same way, rearranged and reinterpreted, but instantly recognisable as part of the same franchise.
Super Spy Science is a fun look, very tongue-in-cheek, at the science of James Bond. All of those big gadgets, the big plans to take over the world, and whether they've been based in a grain of truth or if they're just the figment of some fevered imagination.
And you're more interested in the evil side of James Bond.
Much more fun, in my opinion. James Bond is fantastic, but he's only ever as good as his villains. If he's not up against a credible foe, then why would we be interested in him? And James Bond is remarkable. He has a fantastic set of skills. He has Q Branch behind him, inventing all sorts of things. But the villains, I think, get a bit more creative, and they're a bit more... Well, they're quite ambitious in their goals. So that's the side of it that appeals more to me.
The bad guy is living in very comfortable and technologically well-appointed seclusion, a subterranean palace located on Crab Key Island, with a dragon and swamp to deter visitors, but also luxurious guest accommodation and prison cells for those who can't take the hint, along with a nuclear power plant on the side. With elaborate courtesy, the villain explains his plan for world domination, disrupting rocket launches from the USA using some kind of nuclear-powered radio transmitter. And the villain does all this before trying to kill Bond in an extravagant and convoluted way that enables his escape. The film finishes with a spectacular set piece involving lots of explosions and Bond getting the girl.
Now, if you were a villain living in a hollowed-out volcano, wouldn't that smell quite a bit?
Yeah, it would smell an awful lot like rotten eggs. It would be extremely unpleasant. But I imagine that Blofeld is just going for the looks, and it does look incredible. I just wouldn't want to be there. So I'm quite happy that it's just on screen and I don't have to be in the vicinity. But I love all of those big, fantastic sets. Absolute credit to the filmmakers. They're brilliant.
Dame Agatha Mary Clarissa Christie, 1890 to 1976, the Queen of Crime, holds the Guinness World Record as most successful novelist of all time. She has been outsold only by the Bible and by Shakespeare, and is more widely translated than the Bard. Christie is also the author of the world's longest-running play, The Mousetrap, and created not one but two of the best-known fictional detectives, Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple.
Now, a lot of our listeners are big fans of the audiobooks of Agatha Christie. Tell us about your book, A is for Arsenic.
A is for Arsenic is a very deep, well, it's a deep dive into the poisons that Agatha Christie used in her murder mystery novels. So Agatha Christie is well known as the Queen of Crime, but she is also the Princess of Poisons. She used more poisons more often to kill more characters more accurately than any other crime writer. And her use of poisons, for me as a chemist, is incredibly creative. And some of those poisons, they're almost like an extra character in the book. They are so evocative of the golden age era of crime. And I was just fascinated about how she used them, what clues she might reveal in their use, and how credible it was.
Christie's detective stories repeatedly demonstrate that she was a master of misdirection. She presented clues fairly and in plain sight, often drawing attention to them, but safe in the knowledge that most readers would form their own wrong conclusions. When the murderer is finally revealed, readers are generally left kicking themselves that they didn't spot the obvious, or they cry foul and go back to the beginning, only to discover the clues were there all along.
And our use of potassium in Dumb Witness is a particular favourite of yours.
It is a bit of a favourite of mine. Dumb Witness is perhaps not one of her best known novels, but it is a really creative use of a poison I don't think many people have heard of, but it's certainly, it would have been more known at the time she was writing, back in the 1930s, that particular novel was published. And it has just a fascinating history, which I dive into a bit in the book, as well as her particular use of it. So it's part history, it's part sociology, part criminology, real-life crime, as well as murder mystery.
Now, two of your books we have in the RNIB Talking Books Library are Death by Shakespeare and your book about Frankenstein. Tell us how we could build a body.
Oh, it's tricky. I don't know why, but Victor Frankenstein, for some reason, he built his body from bits. He didn't get a complete corpse and try and bring it back, which I think is a mistake. That seems to me an extra lot of work. It's going to be very difficult today. Getting hold of body bits is not easy. It's also illegal, I would like to add. Please don't do it. But back in Mary Shelley's day, it was frighteningly easy because it was the day of grave robbers and body snatchers that were supplying anatomy schools. So she would have heard all of those gruesome stories and gave all of those skills to Victor Frankenstein and then had him stitch them all together and bring them to life with the other fascination of the day scientifically, which was electricity.
Now, I know the James Bond books haven't held up well in today's society, especially in the age of Me Too and the age of trying to live a healthier, cleaner, non-smoking life, but recommend a good James Bond title for us.
I would recommend, so this is complete personal prejudice that I am going to recommend this one. I am going to recommend Moonraker because it is set not in exotic locations or far-flung parts of the world. It's in the bit of the UK that I grew up in, which is Kent. So when he's talking about a lorry chase up a hill, I know that hill extremely well. And it's a very far-fetched novel, but it is also the one novel in the Me Too movement where he does not get the girl. The girl walks straight past him and into the arms of her future husband. So it's got a very nice ending from that point of view.
Catherine Harkup's books Making the Monster, The Science Behind Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and Death by Shakespeare, Snakebites, Stabbings and Broken Hearts are both available in the RNIB Talking Books Library. A is for Arsenic and Super Spy Science are both available in audio commercially. And the RNIB version of Moonraker is read by George Hagen.
The 238s roared simultaneously. The walls of the underground room took the crash of sound and batted it to and fro between them until there was silence. James Bond watched the smoke being sucked from each end of the room towards the central Ventaxia fan. The memory in his right hand of how he had drawn and fired with one sweep from the left made him confident. He broke the chamber sideways out of the Colt Detective Special and waited, his gun pointing at the floor, while the instructor walked the 20 yards towards him through the half-light of the gallery. Bond saw that the instructor was grinning. "I don't believe it," he said. "I got you that time." The instructor came up with him. "I'm in hospital, but you're dead, sir," he said. In one hand, he held the silhouette target of the upper body of a man. In the other, a Polaroid film, postcard size. He handed this to Bond, and they turned to a table behind them, on which there was a green-shaded desk light and a large magnifying glass. Bond picked up the glass and bent over the photograph. It was a flashlight photograph of him. Around his right hand, there was a blurred burst of white flame. He focused the glass carefully on the left side of his dark jacket. In the center of his heart, there was a tiny pinpoint of light.
George Hagen reading from the RNIB version of Moonraker, as recommended by chemist and author Catherine Harkup. And we'll find two brand new books also in the RNIB library after this.
I've been involved in the talking book service for a long time, since I was just starting out as an actor.
Julian Fellows on supporting talking books.
I suppose what draws me to it is that my whole life has been based around the word, you know, as an actor and then a screenwriter and a novelist and everything else, and the thought of being deprived of the word is terrifying to me. But also what is really crucial to the Talking Book Service is it makes blind people autonomous. You want to get back some of the pleasures that you knew before, and the one that can come back 100% unqualified is reading a book, and that is because of the Talking Book Service.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now a return to RNIB Library for two brand new books.
HarperCollins have given us You Never Know, a memoir by Tom Selleck.
On a sweeping turn, one of the wheels slipped off the pavement onto the soft dirt shoulder. The rear engine car immediately lost traction, went into an uncontrolled skid, and over the edge. Everything after that seemed to slow down. I was in the passenger seat as the car floated in the air, turning over on its axis. We had been bowling, and the two bowling balls flew around the cabin, seeking and all too often finding their target. It was a dark night, and I couldn't see where the descent was taking us. Then I felt a painful, overwhelming crunch as the car hit the ground upside down. Thank God it was over. But suddenly, we were airborne again, turning over and over as we fell farther. Then another agonizing crunch, landing on the passenger side. There was no window by now, and I felt the ground brush my right arm, somehow not crushing it as the car kept rolling. Back into the dark air, turning over once more, and landing right side up. I put my left hand up against the crumpled ceiling, bracing myself for what was sure to come next, but it never came. My mom's red Corvair Monza had landed on a flat spot on the steep slope and rested there. There was an eerie quiet of settling metal.
You Never Know is an intimate memoir from a beloved actor, the story of a remarkable life and a thoroughly accidental career. Journey to the top in Hollywood, learn of his mistakes and his well-earned success. Selleck clears up an armload of misconceptions and shares never-told stories. His rambunctious California childhood, his clueless arrival as a good-looking college jock in Hollywood, from the dating game to the Fox New Talent program to co-starring with Mae West. What was it like to emerge as a megastar in his mid-30s and remain so for decades to come? An actor whose ease on screen connected with audiences worldwide while redefining the cliches of manhood. Selleck recounts his personal friendships, with a vivid army of A-listers, everyone from Frank Sinatra to Carol Burnett to Sam Elliott, paying special tribute to his mentor James Garner of the Roxford Files, who believed, like Selleck, the TV protagonists are more interesting when they have rough edges. Magnum fans will be fascinated to learn how Selleck put his career on the line to make Thomas Magnum a more imperfect hero, and explains why he walked away from a show that could easily have gone on for years longer. Selleck explains how he struggled to balance his personal and professional lives, frequently adjusting his career to protect his privacy and normalcy. His journey offers a fresh perspective on a changing industry and a changing world.
I thought I was thinking clearly. The Showmen were blaring on the radio, "Rock and Roll Will Stand." I turned off the radio. I turned off the headlights. The headlights were gone. I turned off the engine, which was no longer running. I guess I wasn't thinking very clearly. What about Vicky? My girlfriend, Vicky Wheeler, was upside down in the back seat. There were no seat belts in 1962. She was just starting to wake up as I helped her onto the seat, and I could see her blonde hair was soaked with blood. "Are you okay, Vic?" "Yeah, I think so." It seemed to hit us both at the same time. "Where's Steve?" she said. I had let my friend Steve Lowe drive my mom's car, but he was no longer inside. I jumped out and started to yell, "Steve! Steve!" Finally, up from the dark slope, I heard, "I'm up here." "Steve, are you okay?" "I think so, but it hurts when I move."
You Never Know, a memoir by Tom Selleck, is read by Tom Selleck and Ellis Hennigan, and runs for 15 hours and 27 minutes.
The Proof of My Innocence is by Jonathan Cole. It was donated by Penguin Random House.
Phil leaned forward on the garden bench and felt a shiver run through her body. It was 7:40. The sun was already setting, and the evenings were starting to feel colder. The privet hedge, tall and perfectly trimmed, was casting its long shadow across the lawn, which her father had mown into neat stripes a few days earlier. From the depths of the lily pond, Gregory, the ancient and alliterative goldfish, rose occasionally to the surface and blew indifferent kisses in her direction with his bulbous lips. Birds she could not have identified were singing their sunset songs from the branches of trees she could not have named. Clouds punctuated the reddening sky, and between them in the distance she could make out the silver glint of an aeroplane making its slow descent to Heathrow. It was a scene of lovely tranquility, which left her completely cold. She had solved today's Wordle in 3 guesses, and checking her stats, discovered that she now had a streak of 68. That meant that today, Friday the 2nd of September, marked 68 days since she had left university.
Post-university life doesn't suit Phil. Time passes slowly living back at home with her parents, working a zero-hour contract serving Japanese food to holidaymakers at Heathrow's Terminal 5. As for her budding plans to become a writer, those are going nowhere. That is until family friend Chris comes to stay. He's been on the path to uncover a sinister think tank founded at Cambridge University in the 1980s. It's been scheming to push the British government in a more extreme direction, one that's finally poised to put their plans into action. But speaking truth to power can be dangerous, and power will stop at nothing to stay on top. As Britain finds itself under the leadership of a new Prime Minister, whose tenure will only last for 7 weeks, Chris pursues his story to a conference being held deep in the Cotswolds, where events take a sinister turn and a murder inquiry is soon in progress. But will the solution to the mystery lie in contemporary politics or in a literary enigma that is almost 40 years old?
68 days since her father had driven up to Newcastle in the new Toyota of which he was so proud, crammed her possessions into the back, and carried her away for good from the filthy, mouldering, rat-infested house where she had spent the happiest year of her life. Away from the six friends, whose annoying attitudes, banal conversation, and gross personal habits she missed more than she could ever have imagined. Away from all that, and back home to the comfort, quietude, and stultifying affluence of her aging parents' daily existence. She shivered again. 7:17. Time seemed to pass so slowly when she wasn't at work.
The Proof of My Innocence by Jonathan Coe has multiple narrators: Sam Wolfe, Alana Maria, Charlotte Worthing, Mark Stobbard, and Roy McMillan, and runs for 12 hours and 14 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Percival Everett for the books of his life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
I came to writing later, but certainly I was a reader. And I think the first works I read were Lewis Carroll. And the first actual novel, I didn't really read children's books, and I don't know how what that world was like when I was a kid. It's incredible now. I have children, and I loved the books that they experienced early on quite much. But the first adult novel I read at 9 was Somerset Maugham's Of Human Bondage. And obviously, I didn't understand a lot of it, but I realized that I was reading something I shouldn't be reading, which was great fun. And then I read Twain's Life on the Mississippi and Roughing It and any number of sort of exciting novels. I had access to my father and grandfather's libraries, and so I read quite a bit. And then when I was a teenager, preteen, I discovered Kurt Vonnegut and consumed everything that he wrote.
The day broke gray and dull. The clouds hung heavily, and there was a rawness in the air that suggested snow. A woman servant came into a room in which a child was sleeping and drew the curtains. She glanced mechanically at the house opposite, a stucco house with a portico, and went to the child's bed.
"Wake up, Philip," she said.
She pulled down the bedclothes, took him in her arms, and carried him downstairs. He was only half awake.
"Your mother wants you," she said.
She opened the door of a room on the floor below and took the child over to a bed in which a woman was lying. It was his mother. She stretched out her arms, and the child nestled by her side. He did not ask why he had been awakened. The woman kissed his eyes and with thin, small hands felt the warm body through his white flannel nightgown. She pressed him closer to herself.
"Are you sleepy, darling?" she said.
Her voice was so weak that it seemed to come already from a great distance. The child did not answer, but smiled comfortably. He was very happy in the large, warm bed, with those soft arms about him. He tried to make himself smaller still, as he cuddled up against his mother, and he kissed her sleepily. In a moment he closed his eyes and was fast asleep. The doctor came forwards and stood by the bedside.
"Oh, don't take him away yet," she moaned.
The doctor, without answering, looked at her gravely. Knowing she would not be allowed to keep the child much longer, the woman kissed him again, and she passed her hand down his body till she came to his feet. She held the right foot in her hand and felt the 5 small toes, and then slowly passed her hand over the left one. She gave a sob.
"What's the matter?" said the doctor. "You're tired."
She shook her head, unable to speak, and the tears rolled down her cheeks. The doctor bent down.
Let me take him.
Of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham is available in the RNIB Talking Books Library as read by Christopher Oxford. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
Yes, I read it every year, and that's The Way of All Flesh, Samuel Butler. It's remarkably funny, but I love the way he outlines the history of the protagonist's family with detail, but yet with broad strokes, and the understated nature of the humor and of the drama I am just drawn into. In fact, Erewhon is also another of my favorites. I am a big fan of Samuel Butler. The other novel that probably has influenced me more than anything, though it's not a book you cuddle up with, is Tristram Shandy.
When I was a small boy, at the beginning of the century, I remember an old man who wore knee breeches and worsted stockings and who used to hobble about the street of our village with the help of a stick. He must have been getting on for 80 in the year 1807, earlier than which date I suppose I can hardly remember him, for I was born in 1802. A few white locks hung about his ears, his shoulders were bent, and his knees feeble, but he was still hale, and was much respected in our little world of Palham. His name was Pontifex. His wife was said to be his master. I've been told she brought him a little money, but it cannot have been much. She was a tall, square-shouldered person. I've heard my father call her a Gothic woman, who'd insisted on being married to Mr. Pontifex when he was young and too good-natured to say nay to any woman who wooed him. The pair had lived not unhappily together, for Mr. Pontifex's temper was easy, and he soon learned to bow before his wife's more stormy moods. Mr. Pontifex was a carpenter by trade. He was also at one time parish clerk. When I remember him, however, he'd so far risen in life as to be no longer compelled to work with his own hands. In his earlier days, he'd taught himself to draw. I do not say he drew well, but it was surprising he should draw as well as he did. My father, who took the living of Palham about the year 1797, became possessed of a good many of old Mr. Pontifex's drawings, which were always of local subjects, and so unaffectedly painstaking that they might have passed for the work of some good early master. I remember them as being hanging up, framed and glazed, in the study at the rectory, and tinted, as all else in the room was tinted, with the green reflected from the fringe of ivy leaves that grew around the windows.
That's John Richmond reading The Way of All Flesh by Samuel Butler, available from RNIB Talking Books.
And just finally, is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently. It's fresh in the mind, and you'd like to recommend it to the listeners.
Yes, there is. There's a book about music, about Dvorak. It's been really important to me lately. David Horowitz, called Dvorak's Prophecy.
The Dvorak's Prophecy isn't available in audio, although in the RNIB Talking Books Library, and available commercially, is The Life and Works of Dvorak by Jeremy Seatman.
As with many composers, Dvorak's road to self-discovery was a long one, which he travelled with a rare single-minded determination. In addition to the organ, he studied singing and musical theory, and spent long hours with the music of Mozart, Beethoven, and Schubert, who remained his lifelong heroes. He also played the violin and viola in one of the Prague orchestras, where he was joined in 1858 by the young Adolf Čech, later to succeed Smetana as music director at the National Theatre. He didn't find Dvorak an easy colleague.
"I joined the orchestra as a viola player. You will play at the same desk as Dvorak," said the director, and introduced me to a young man with a mane of tousled, thick black hair. We were both less than 20 at that time, and I can tell you that playing with Dvorak was no easy matter. Now my playing did not please him. Now he was annoyed with the next desk. At other times he was dissatisfied with the conductor, or with himself. And now and again he would stop playing altogether, and start humming some scrap of melody to himself.
Another orchestral colleague, Jan Kvatza, also suggests that the young Dvorak could be a difficult customer.
He was very easily roused, quick-tempered and impatient. On the whole, however, he dealt with those who annoyed him by the simple expedient of avoiding them wherever possible.
But then he had a lot on his mind. In 1859, the small allowance from his uncle came to an end, leaving him to fend for himself. For the next few years, he lived in considerable poverty. He made what money he could from his orchestral playing and some private teaching, but it was barely enough to provide him with lodgings, much less to attend to his musical needs.
Dvorak was too poor to have his own piano, and so he often came round to our apartment to play his things over. My mother hardly welcomed these visits, since he always left his footmarks on the newly scrubbed floor.
The Life and Works of Antonín Dvořák is written and read by Jeremy Seepman. It also features Sean Barrett as Dvořák and has contributions from many RNIB narrators, such as Jonathan Keeble, Garrick Hagen, Caroline Friend, Daniel Philpott and Michael Tudor Barnes. It's available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books. Once again, Percival Everett, thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.